You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.
Hi, and welcome to Spycast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Andrew Hammond, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, Spycast brings you interesting conversations from authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns about Spycast, or if you want to suggest someone who might be a good future guest, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. Also, if you like what you hear, and even if you don't, please take a minute to review us on iTunes and whatever platform you might be listening from. We're always looking for ways to make Spycast better, and you can help.
Welcome to this week's edition of Spycast. Shadow Wars, Israel, Iran, and America. This is the second in a two-part series where we look at the history of Israeli intelligence. So last week, we took a deep dive into some of the backstory of Israeli intelligence. We looked at the period between 1948 and 2012. This week, we're walking the story up to the present day, and I mean the present day. So we're looking at the recent assassination of the Iranian nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. We're looking at the transition from Trump to Biden, and we're going to consider some of the underlying dynamics that are shaping the world of Israeli intelligence. For this week's episode, I'm joined by Yossi Melman. He's an Israeli journalist who works for Haaretz. He was formerly at the Jerusalem Post, but he recently returned to Haaretz. He was a historical advisor on the Netflix series Inside the Mossad. So if anyone's not seen it yet, I would strongly recommend it. And it was him that persuaded many Mossad members to speak. I'm also joined by Dan Raviv. So Dan's a native New Yorker, and he was with CBS News for over 40 years. He was at the Tel Aviv and London bureaus, and latterly, the national correspondent for CBS. So these two gentlemen have authored a number of books together, including Every Spy a Prince, A Complete History of Israel's Intelligence Community, and Spies Against Armageddon, Inside Israel's Secret Wars. I hope you enjoy this week's episode as much as I enjoyed speaking to Yossi and Dan. So I wondered if we could start off with the recent death of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Any thoughts, gentlemen?
Well, I assume it was a Mossad operation, although Israel hasn't taken any claim and responsibility for it. And when we say Mossad operation, it's always, there is a myth that the Mossad is everything, but basically it's a joint project, joint venture, joint operation of military intelligence, which is the biggest, largest, and the most important in the country, responsible for running agents, research above all, and Unit 8200, which is equivalent to the US NSA. So it was a joint operation. I assume it took them many, many years and it certainly months to pursue the guy. He was wanted by the Mossad. He was well known to many intelligence organizations around the globe, CIA, German, BND, French, British, MI6, and so on. He was the architect of their military nuclear program, which was secret, hidden. I think there was an attempt on his life once in the past, at least once in the past, although he was highly wanted. And I believe that it was the junction of good intelligence, precise, accurate information, operational feasibility, and then came the question of timing, which we can later relate to whether it was wise to do it before Joe Biden enters the White House.
I, of course, was reminded as an American, the American member of this writing team, of what President Donald Trump had decided to do, and that was the assassination of General Soleimani, who was by far the most important Iranian organizer of Iran's activities all around the world, especially in the Middle East. He was frequently in Syria in the years of the civil war there, architect of supporting the Hezbollah political and terrorist group of Shiite Muslims in Lebanon. The United States, President Trump had it with Soleimani and his activities and decided to send a message. In this case, apparently U.S. drone aircraft killed Soleimani by firing missiles in Baghdad, Iraq, just after Soleimani arrived there on a trip. And so it's the matter of the decision, of course, but what I'm thinking about in terms of the spy game is if a leader of a country wants options, whether it's Trump as president of the United States or Benjamin Netanyahu as prime minister of Israel, and the option to strike at your enemy, maybe by assassinating someone who is senior, you'd expect your intelligence agencies to follow that man, to follow the possible target. So certainly when Soleimani was killed by the Americans, and now Fakhrizadeh, killed probably by the Israelis, you sort of realize that there are targets being followed probably constantly. And maybe they lose sight of the target, and then there's an opportunity because they know that he's traveling or he's in a certain place. And then it's really just up to the decision-making process whether to kill someone. It's not a decision taken lightly, certainly, by any democratic government. But it's one of the options in these secret wars. After all, it's not a declared war with armies between Iran and Israel or between Iran and the United States, but it's a shadow war in both cases.
We can obviously put the pieces of the puzzle together just thinking about international politics, but is there a particular MO or the particular fingerprints that Mossad leaves behind when they're conducting an operation?
Yeah, I would say that the evidence is circumstantial. Obviously, he was wanted. The Mossad never hid the fact that he is wanted. The Israeli intelligence. The pattern was similar, although it's not unique to the Mossad. The pattern of assassinations are well known to many in other places, including in the underworld and in the criminal activities. And thirdly, Israel did kill in the past 5-6 scientists between 2010 and 2012. And also there were some little bits of hints coming out of Israel. And then prior to the assassination, there was a meeting between Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. He was in Israel and he met with Netanyahu. And he was previously was the director of CIA. He's a good friend and of Yossi Cohen, the head of Mossad, and I assume there was a preliminary discussion before the assassination with the Americans. Otherwise, it would be very, very difficult because of the ramifications. No one knew what the Iranians would, how they would react, how would they, whether they would retaliate immediately or not, and against whom. They could have already retaliated against the Americans. The U.S. has a strong presence in the Persian Gulf, two bases in Qatar and Bahrain. So all in all, this is the evidence, and it's and Israel is the usual suspect.
It also, I think, is noteworthy that only recently it was revealed, again with Israel and the United States not confirming this, that at the request of the United States, Israel's spies or agents in Iran assassinated a senior man in Al-Qaeda, the terrorist group. Abu Muhammad al-Masri was killed in Iran's capital, Tehran, in August. And the New York Times reported that Israel accomplished that at the request of the United States. And so attacking Iran, embarrassing or humiliating Iran, striking at terrorist groups in the Middle East, perhaps even more than ever during the Donald Trump years, was something that the United States and Israel would do together. It's an interesting phenomenon because when Israel reputedly staged at least five attacks on Iranian nuclear scientists in Iran, and especially in the year 2011, it was thought that that was without the United States, Israel acting alone, even though, as Yossi has pointed out, retaliation could be against Americans in Iran and other Persian, against Americans in Iraq and other Persian Gulf countries. Israel was acting alone on its own campaign to discourage Iran's nuclear scientists, to demonstrate what Israeli agents can do. But now the coordination, well, it's really unusual, I have to say, the U.S. and Israel, again, circumstantial evidence, but apparently cooperating in this shadow war against Iran.
Well, I can add to it that I just interviewed the former CIA director, John Brennan, and in the interview, he says, and also I talked to Israeli senior Mossad officials before the interview, and they told me that the level of cooperation between United intelligence communities of Israel and the United States has never been higher, closer than ever. So you can assume that they are. The United States and Israel are privy to the most of the secrets, at least in the Middle East, intelligence secrets in the Middle East, and they cooperate and consult with each other. Not to mention that there are differences, as Dan pointed out. The United States is ready to kill terrorists, which is also a change of policy since 9/11. That wasn't the case before 9/11, but they are very reluctant. The United States is very reluctant, or even is avoiding to kill officials, state officials. And Soleimani was a general, so he was kind of a state official, and yet Trump ordered his killing. Fakhir Zadeh was a state official. He was a brigadier general with the title of a deputy defense minister. So that's it. That's the only difference. Israel doesn't hesitate to kill both terrorists and officials of the enemy if they are involved in actions and activities which Israel perceives as hostile or threatening its existence.
Yossi, I noticed that you recently, as you say, interviewed John Brennan, who not only is a former CIA director and was a senior advisor to President Barack Obama But of course, he served governments of both sides. But during the Trump years, Brennan became a very open critic of President Trump. And so in general, Brennan is seen here in the U.S. as being, well, with the Democrats, with the liberals, in general. So I was struck in your interview that when Brennan was critical of assassinating a foreign government official and how that in effect breaks the rules, and he said, would you want Russia and China to do that in the United States and target U.S. government officials? And I had this notion like it breaks the standards, breaks the rules of the spy game. It made me wonder, with Joe Biden becoming president of the United States, whether that'll be the new attitude. And Yossi, as you sit in Israel and you're in touch with Israeli officials and spy masters, they also must be wondering whether Biden as president and the Democrats in charge might even affect the cooperation with Israel and the Mossad.
I don't think so. I think the Biden, look, Biden doesn't shed tears about the killing of Fakhir Zadeh. He doesn't, I'm sure about it. Neither his aides and staff and team. He would be more careful, obviously. He would try to tell Israel and via the intelligence community, the Mossad and the military intelligence, you have to take into consideration more American interests. What would be the results and ramifications if you act unilaterally? That would be kind of a warning. And I think Israel would listen. I mean, for Israel, the most important asset is the United States. It's not killing Iranians in the streets of Tehran. And by the way, Israel is using assassination as a last resort, really as a last resort. I mean, there is this common notion that the Mossad is a murder incorporated left and right. They're killing left and right. No. It's, I mean, I don't know the exact numbers of how many people were killed outside the borders of Israel by the Mossad, which is, the Mossad is a foreign intelligence agency, operates only outside Israeli borders, not even the occupied West Bank and in Gaza ruled by Hamas. So, you know, it's very measured. It's the numbers are very few. Therefore, Israel would be maybe now, once Biden enters the White House, more careful about it. But still, I don't think it would be the end of the game. And one more point, final one regarding this aspect. Even when Mossad are organizing, planning, and executing an assassination attempt on Iranian targets, they know that sooner or later they would find someone else who would replace whoever is the target. So they know it's a short-lived operation, aiming to slow down, in the case of the nuclear program, to slow it down, to delay, to sabotage it. But they know it would not stop their aspiration to have a nuclear program.
So there's two relationships there that I would like to explore a little bit more. So Israel and Iran, which is obviously an adversary, and Israel and the United States, which is an ally. Could you tell us what the nature of the Israeli-American relationship is?
Well, about the FBI and Israel's domestic security agency, Shin Bet, in some ways equivalent, though frankly, Shin Bet, the security agency in Israel, seems to me far more active, including keeping an eye, of course, for foreign spies, for Arab terrorists, including Palestinians, and for subversive activities occasionally by Jewish citizens of Israel. Three quarters of Israel's almost 10 million people are Jewish. It's thought of as the Jewish state, but there are a lot of political opinions, including extremists on one side or the other, including extremists who want to keep the captured West Bank forever. And so these are all of the duties of Shin Bet. So do Shin Bet and the FBI sometimes have to work together? Oh, it's a matter of international cases. that involve terrorism, that involve financial crime. Sure. But it's worth mentioning that many, many officials of the FBI for decades feel that Israel has been spying on the United States. Of course, they point at the famous case of Jonathan Pollard, an American who worked for U.S. Naval Intelligence and was caught in Washington in 1985 spying for Israel. And there are still FBI officials who assume that Israel is doing that, even though Israel has publicly said it was a mistake, it regrets it, and would never do it again. So I think there's some suspicion. So I think there's still an atmosphere of suspicion that many in the FBI feel toward Israel, though because the countries are allies, of course, they work together. I don't think the Mossad and the CIA have that problem there. It's the fact that the two countries, with the United States being immense, more than 300 million people, and Israel fewer than 10 million, have such different interests. But as we've said, they've cooperated a lot in recent years.
Yeah, I agree with Dan. And the FBI is more suspicious because it's also an agency in charge of counter-espionage. So they, and since Israel had such a long history, the Pollard case, unlike what the Israeli government said at the time, that it was a renegade operation, it was part of an ongoing operation since 48, 49, 50. And in our book, we talk about it extensively, that it all, there were many, many incidents in which mainly on technological scientific espionage, but there were cases in which Israelis tried and succeeded to steal from America uranium, data, know-how, military equipment, or blueprints for military equipment. So the FBI was highly suspicious, and they got the ultimate evidence with the arrest of Pollard. But I believe that since then things have changed. I don't believe that since 1985 Israel has ever spied on American soil. I think that's the last thing that they would do. And the relations between the FBI and Shin Bet are not bad at all. There is even a representative, a liaison officer, in both places. So there is a cooperation between the two countries, and there is a Shin Bet liaison in Washington, D.C.
Hey, everybody. Today, I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business.
So, for example, Mossad and the CIA have a close working relationship, and the CIA and MI6 have a close working relationship. To what extent does that circle ever get completed?
Andrew, that's the kind of thing that actually can fluctuate over the years. Shortly after World War II, when there was a sense in Western countries that the Soviet Union, Russia, was an enemy, and worldwide communism was an enemy, very intense cooperation by intelligence agencies was part of the same process that created the NATO alliance. And so it was totally normal for there to be meetings that would include the CIA, also the British, MI6, or Secret Intelligence Service, the French, over the years, the West Germans, later Germans, Australia, New Zealand would be involved. So Israel was not in that group. Israel was small. Early on, just after World War II and in the 1950s, many Western countries weren't sure about Israel. What side is Israel on? Is it kind of a socialist country? But over the years, certainly Israel has proved its value, first of all, its talent and strength in the fields of intelligence, gathering information and also operations. Also, Israel has proved that it is a Western country in its politics and outlook. And so I think that Israel does have the same allies as the United States. But again, because Israel has different interests, Israel has a very complex set of connections, even in what we would think of as enemy countries. In the past few years, it's now almost an open secret that Saudi Arabia and Israel have had meetings, apparently including the highest government officials in secret, but certainly the Mossad and the intelligence chiefs of Saudi Arabia, of other Arab and Muslim countries, Indonesia, a massive Muslim country, had a lot of relations with Israel. By the way, the Mossad has traditionally acted as an alternative foreign ministry. And so if there would be nations, and there were many, that refused to open embassies in Israel, refused to have open relations with the state of Israel, the Mossad would be the secret diplomats. There's very little of that the CIA has ever had to do.
Just to clarify, in Israel, you don't have political appointees heading up the intelligence agencies. Is that correct?
Yes, it is correct. The heads of the intelligence community, the Shin Bet and Mossad, they report to the prime minister. The head of the chief of the military intelligence reports to the chief of staff and through him to the defense minister. So the head of military intelligence is a military officer, is a military general. The head of Shabak and the head of Mossad are civilians. And they report to the prime minister. They are appointed by the prime minister, but have to end by the defense minister if it's the military intelligence, but they have to be confirmed by the government, by the cabinet.
And just to clarify, there's no equivalent of the ODNI like there is in the United States. There's no kind of meta agency that's in charge of all of these intelligence agencies. Is that correct?
Yes, there is no. I mean, the agency have been reformed and changed according to the environment, demands, requests, necessities, but they remain the same old solid agency. There were not many changes in that mm-hmm. sense. There have been technological changes inside each agency, but that's all.
And let's pivot to the shadow war that Dan referred to. Are, for example, Israeli nuclear scientists looking over their shoulder? What's kind of going on with that cat and mouse relationship between Israel and Iran in terms of the shadow war?
Andrew, it's a good question. Yes, the Israeli Bureau of Anti-Terrorism is issuing from time to time travel bans or warnings, and there have been in the past public warnings, but also messages were conveyed privately that scientists working for the Israeli Atomic Energy Commission have been warned that the Iranians are trying to target them. So be careful if you travel abroad, be, you know, exercise extra caution and be prepared for the worst. And Iran has been threatening to retaliate Israel after almost each operation in which scientists or even terrorists have been assassinated. And it doesn't matter if they were senior or junior officers. And Israeli and Iran has been threatening to target Israeli embassies, and in some cases they succeeded. So retaliation is part of the, and revenge. The Iranians are using the word revenge too often. So it's part of the shadow war. Yes, it is.
How does Israeli intelligence manage to operate in a country like Iran that a lot of other intelligence agencies struggle to gain any traction in?
Well, when we wrote about Israeli intelligence as early as the late 80s, when Yossi and I started writing books together, so in Spies Against Armageddon is our most recent, but in Every Spy a Prince, way back in 1990, we already pointed out that one of the strengths of Israel's intelligence community is linguistic skills, having many immigrants to Israel, basically Jews who moved from Arab countries and from Iran, and frankly from many countries all around the world, but especially Middle Eastern countries. And so there are Israeli citizens whose families speak these languages, have kept many of the cultural habits of those countries. Obviously, as the years have gone by, and Israel is now more than 70 years old, the country was created in 1948, that starts to fade, but you can revive it. There are Israelis who are familiar with the cultures of those countries, and that helps. That helps you penetrate those countries. If there are lots of people in Israel who have lived in Iran, or parents were living there until they moved to Israel, the language Persian or Farsi, you sort of sharpen it if necessary. On the other hand, maybe I don't want to emphasize that too much, because like other intelligence agencies, the Mossad is very good at languages, in that you could be someone born in Egypt and they would teach you the Syrian accent of Arabic, or maybe even teach you Farsi, the Persian language. And so with time, you will be able to penetrate Iran, but still that is a help. Also, frankly, Israel's capability to monitor the other countries in the Middle East, to listen to, of course, the radio stations and the TV, but also many phone conversations of the military and of government chiefs all over the region. This is something that the Israelis were good at early on. We know, and Israel would never admit this, that they actually send spies into foreign countries to install recording devices in buildings, in embassies, in telephone exchanges, at intersections in Arab countries, and then return to Israel secretly. So again, the monitoring is not just acquiring information, but also acquiring the latest about the culture in that country. So how to behave, what towns and villages could be vulnerable, where you could possibly blackmail someone in order to help you in some ways. And the Israelis are just so very skilled at many of these tools and capabilities. Iran is no exception. And one way that this capability was highlighted in public was just over 2 years ago in 2018, when Prime Minister Netanyahu decided to have a press conference in Israel with slides and props showing that the Mossad had stolen a giant nuclear archive from a warehouse in Tehran. This had to involve many, many agents and transportation and trucks and getting, frankly, tons of material out of Iran and across the border to one of the neighboring countries and then to Israel. Again, they didn't say exactly how they did it, but just the fact that Israel was able to do it was a stunning reminder that Israel is able to operate in that enemy country, Iran.
Israel, the Mossad is recruiting also agents, foreign agents, what the CIA calls foreign assets. So you also use them. You recruit agents for whatever, I mean, they are ready to cooperate and work with you for whatever reason, money, ideology, hatred of the other, jealousy, whatever, for all the reasons that the intelligence or agencies are manipulating or using. And that also helps. So, to the credit of Israeli intelligence, I would say that to operate in Iran, it's even harder than for the MI6 or the CIA. The MI6 is considered to be, or the British are considered to be, rivalries. I wouldn't say they are enemies of Iran. If you ask Iranian officials, they would say maybe now we are in confrontation, but basically there is no, there is some historical background of hatred between Iran and Britain or America. But America was and Britain were allies of Iran until the Khomeini came to power in 1979, after the Islamic Revolution. So it's even harder for Israel to penetrate Iran, and still Israel is doing it time and again. It shows also that we're talking about intelligence and about collecting information, but there is also a psychological effect to it. Think about the impact which such a penetration is creating among the leaders of Iran. I mean, the supreme leader and his aides are thinking, oh my God, the Israelis can reach any one of us if they kill the Fakhir Zadeh, or if the Americans kill Soleimani, anyone can be a target. And it creates a havoc in the leadership. And they, after each such an assassination or targeted killing or bombing operation, the Iranians are chasing, looking for traitors who helped us. And there is a psychological, it's a demoralizing effect when you conduct an operation in Iran successfully. Judging from past precedents, the Iranians were not successful in penetrating Israel. There were a few spies, small fish caught in Israel, sent on mission by the Iranian intelligence. I think it's a problem of dictatorships. They are most concerned about their own domestic affairs, chasing dissidents, political enemies, their political enemies, and they try less to focus on foreign operations. Now the Iranians have tried, as we said before, to target Israeli embassies, Israeli diplomats, but outside the Israeli borders, it's very difficult for them to penetrate Israel, because they don't know the language, because they don't know the culture, or know less than Israel knows Iranian culture. So yes, they are chasing, they are trying to operate in Israel. Sometimes they're using proxies like Hezbollah in Lebanon.
An example that comes to mind would be the two bombings in Argentina, the capital Buenos Aires, in 1992. The Israeli embassy was targeted. And in 1994, the Jewish Community Center. And in those attacks, in total, more than 110 people were killed, And investigations have shown that Iran was involved, that the Lebanese Hezbollah was involved, that their paid agents in South America were activated. And so years after some event that Iran gets angry about, years later, there might be an action by Iranian agents anywhere on earth, and they'll say it was revenge. But you asked about penetrating Israel. As we see, both Iran and Hezbollah haven't been very penetrating Iran.
And one of the things that I find interesting is there a specific Israeli intelligence culture? So, for example, like compared to an American intelligence culture or a British intelligence culture, is there a certain way that Israel does intelligence?
I would say that it's, yes, there is. The Israeli intelligence is more daring, is ready to take more risks, unlike the MI6 or CIA. It's a result of the circumstances of the geostrategic posture of Israel in the Middle East. We have been surrounded by enemies until 77, when President Anwar Assad came to Jerusalem and later on, 2 years later, signed a peace treaty with Israel, the Camp David agreement on the White House lawns, and then another country signed a peace treaty with Israel, Jordan, which is a good, very very good ally of Israel strategically. And the Jordanians depend on Israel to a degree, and there is a good cooperation between the intelligence services of Israel, Egypt, and Jordan. But being surrounded by enemies, Israel had to develop to be more motivated, because the threat was bigger, and the feeling that it's that almost everything is existential. It's a threat to the very existence of Israel. So that's the Israeli culture. But there are also weaknesses in the Israeli intelligence culture. It's the approach that we know better, not to mention arrogancy. So I would say that Israeli intelligence is among the top five best intelligence agencies in the world.
I mean, I think it's extraordinary that people all over the world know of these names, but if you just look at Israel in terms of population, it's very small. But I guess what you're saying, Yossi, is that this skill set has almost had to develop by necessity because of the geopolitical situation that Israel finds itself in.
Yes, and also what Dan just said, that it's an Israel has been a society of immigrants and absorbed a lot of people from more than 100 countries, from Afghanistan to the United States, from Iran to the Soviet Union, Russia. So it helps, you know, it helps to cultivate a culture of skillful intelligence operatives and also analysts, researchers.
Has that ever posed a counterintelligence or counter-espionage problem for Israel, having immigrants coming from all of these different countries?
Well, actually, the at least if you judge based on precedent. The biggest threat or the biggest counterintelligence challenge for Israel was from the Soviet Union, because the Soviet Union, the KGB, was a good espionage agency, unlike the Israeli neighbors, the Arab countries. They were weak. So yes, Israel has been penetrated throughout the years with spies, mainly originating in the Soviet Union, and some of them I know about the cases that were exposed. Those spies were arrested and exposed and sent to jail. We don't know what we don't know. And I assume there were more spies which we didn't, that Israel didn't find out about them. So yes, there were spies in the Shin Bet, among the ranks of Shin Bet. There were spies in the ranks of Mossad. Very few, very rarely, because Israel is a very homogeneous society and people, there is a sense of kinship between the people, although it is disintegrating in the last few years, this camaraderie between people. But still, Israel is a society which is difficult to penetrate. There is a great deal of feeling that we are under threat and we should be together, and therefore it's very difficult to penetrate Israel, but it did happen. China is also challenging Israel, but not by using human intelligence, mostly technological espionage or thievery, if you wish.
So we hear here in the United States a lot of discussion about Chinese espionage and stealing technological secrets to spawn off copycat technologies back home. Is that happening in Israel? Because I know Israel has a very developed technology scene.
Well, just about everybody knows that Israel is very good at technology, has achieved a lot of breakthroughs. Its scientists win international prizes. Israeli startup companies are leaders in technology. Even with the recent trend, the breakthroughs in Israel achieving open, even friendly relations with Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates, there's a lot there. And if you are a competitor of Israel or an enemy of Israel, certainly you want to know what it is that Israeli industry and the Israeli military and its defense industries have come up with in recent years, including commerce and you know, some other countries' military interests, would want to spy on Israel. That doesn't require having clever agents within the borders of Israel. Again, a lot of that penetration can be done electronically from overseas. There is an active cyber war in which Israel's enemies, of course, would try to shut down Israeli utilities, such as the power and the water systems, or be ready to do that. And Israel has a very good reputation at being good also at cyber defense. So I would say that when it comes to the modern means of warfare, no soldiers and maybe no spies on the ground, Israel is definitely in the middle of that new kind of war.
Yes, and but still the Chinese managed in the past to infiltrate some major Israeli military industries. There were reports that they stole know-how, drawings, information from arms manufacturers, and it's ongoing war. The cyber warfare, which Israel, as Dan pointed out, is very good both offensively and defensively, is also, you know, in that war, Israel is a target, and in some cases, the Chinese succeeded. It's interesting also to note that the Chinese are not just spying on Israel as a final destination. They also spy on Israel because they know Israel is a very good friend of the United States. And because of these very close relations, technological exchange, military armaments, and Israel buys from the United States most of its sophisticated weapons, including mainly airplanes, but not only airplanes. So the Chinese also have targeted Israel as a backdoor, as a back channel to penetrate the United States.
I think that this is a good point, Yossi, because we're so used to thinking about some of the daring operations, the things that involve the human or intelligence operatives on the ground. So, but I wondered if you could, you know, retool our listeners to think about Israeli intelligence in the 21st century. What are some of those cyber capabilities? What are some of the kind of things that Israel is doing to start thinking about the future of intelligence?
Well, you know, until 20 years ago or around, the number of people working in the Mossad staff were maybe 3,000. Since then, it's doubled and probably more. Now, the budget has been expanded, and the number of buildings at Mossad headquarters has mushroomed. And mostly of the new recruits and mostly of the new buildings have been built and recruited because they need to improve the cyber capabilities, the technological capabilities of Mossad and also of military intelligence. So in a sense, Israel, the Mossad, which excelled on being a human intelligence-based agency, is becoming more and more technological. It's not unique to Israel, but you rely more and more on signal intelligence, on cyber warfare, and the human intelligence is, I'm not saying it has been dwarfed, but it is now secondary to the importance of technology. And the many veterans of the intelligence community of the Mossad are complaining about this. Not to mention that the Mossad was a very family oriented. If you have a small number of employees, everyone knows each other. Now with 7,000 or more, someone told me that during break time, during lunch time, the dining rooms at the Mossad reminded him of Japanese crashing on the doors in Tokyo of the subway. I mean, they are rushing it. So it means that, you know, people are, a lot of people there, and they don't know each other, and they are strange to each other. It's good and bad, but that's the reality.
Has this changed the types of recruits that Israeli intelligence is looking for?
Yes, in a sense, it has changed. If you look at the ads, the Mossad has now a website. Mainly, it's a website to recruit manpower. If you look at the website, you will see that there is a greater demand for technological professions. But still, there are ads for analysts, researchers, and case officers.
I'd have to note that one thing that hasn't changed is that Israeli intelligence apparently is looking for a high degree of patriotism, that you're very motivated to help your country. Yes, you want adventure, you want a challenge, and the Mossad website does talk about that as one of the things you might want to do, but you won't be accepted unless the Mossad feels that you're patriotic and hardworking. A lot of that is demonstrated in military service, because keep in mind that military service is almost universal in Israel. Men generally go for 3 years of service and maybe stay longer. Women go for 2 years. There are ways of getting out of it if you're not, you know, if you totally don't want to do that. But if you do, you're probably going to prove your skills while in the military, including in the military intelligence unit known as 8200, and there are other more specialist units of cyber warfare and communications. And so you'll show your skills, but you also might be an elite soldier in an elite unit of the Israel Defense Forces, and because you also show yourself to be very intelligent and innovative, always thinking of alternative ways of getting things done, thinking outside the box, so you might be an elite soldier in the Army and then be approached by the intelligence community and recruited by the Mossad. Yossi was, I would say, the driving force behind a series you can see on Netflix called Inside the Mossad. And a lot of those old timers talk about how they were recruited and who they and their colleagues were. I don't think that's changed completely in that that's still what Israeli intelligence is looking for, motivated people who think outside the box. And well, frankly, one of the slogans I certainly heard from Israeli veterans of intelligence was, nothing is impossible. That's the way they want to think.
Yes, this is true. The recruitment process is now much more professional. Psychologists and tests and personal evaluation. I can tell you a funny anecdote. One of the legendary spies of Israel, a guy called Rafi Eitan. By the way, he was the guy who ran Pollard. He just passed away a year ago or 2 years ago. I asked him, how were you recruited? And he said, I met the head of the intelligence service, the head of Mossad, the first or the second head of Mossad, Issar Arel, called me. We had known each other from our neighborhood, which was a small rural community. And he said, do you want to work for the Mossad? And the other guy said, yes, I do. He said, what can you do? What are your skills? He said, test me, try me. And he said, okay, I'm now, they went downstairs. He said, do you see now the third floor of this building? Can you get there? He said, sure. And he got there. How did you get there? He climbed the windows. I mean, it will not happen now. So, you know, everything has been changed, modernized, but still I noticed two funny ads in the Mossad website. One, cooks are wanted. Well, you know, it was Napoleon who said about something about, you know, that the army walks on its stomach, on its food, needs food. And the other advert was that the Mossad was looking for a tailor.
Listeners can view Inside the Mossad on Netflix just now, right?
Well, look for Inside the Mossad. That's on Netflix. Great documentary series. Yossi was very much behind that. I'm actually going to recommend a fictional series that's on Apple Plus TV called Tehran. I think it at least gives you a sense of combining human intelligence and the technological capabilities. A female Israeli hacker is sent into Iran by the Mossad. And so it combines a lot there, including language skills. And that's the realistic part of the very fictional story. And of course, I recommend our books. Thank you, Andy.
Thanks for your time. Thanks for your expertise. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.
The International Spy Museum is a full 501c3 nonprofit. If you want to donate to the museum, or if you're local and would like to volunteer at the museum, please visit our website at spymuseum.org for more information.